The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello there. This is Fred Brack from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our program for over 10 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now we return to the August 2019 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. The theme this month is Bringing Back the Sunday Supper. Companionship is the secret ingredients. We read three articles along those lines last week. We're going to move right along to the very next three in sequence. This first one is entitled A Movable Feast. A bipartisan group in Raleigh has created the state's largest supper table to help communities hard hit by disaster. Written by Andrea Weigel, there's a picture of somebody making barbecue here in a smoky grill, and in sort of an aerial shot of long tables, really long tables, lined on both sides by people. Right on Fayetteville Street, what used to be called Fayetteville Street Mall at East Hargett Street. We know this because we can see the street signs. Dozens of dinner tables stretched down Fayetteville Street, anchored by the state capitol at one end and Memorial Auditorium at the other. Hundreds of volunteers prepped drink stations, set out more than 1,000 chairs, and decorate the tables with seashells and sand dollars. Chefs and pitmasters are finishing their dishes, including gallons of Brunswick stew, 90 racks of glazed pork ribs, and 1,000 smoked chicken quarters. Checking in on all of them is Raleigh Chef Scott Crawford, who helped bring these folks together on this Sunday afternoon. Crawford often cooks for charity dinners, but today the logistics are mind-boggling. He's serving up North Carolina's signature dishes at a sit-down dinner that spans two city blocks. The plan didn't start that way for Crawford. The chef, who owns the acclaimed Crawford & Son restaurant, had heard that the team behind the supper, or rather the Sunday Supper organization, was planning an event for hurricane relief, and he wanted to do something too. This time it really hit home. I thought Hurricane Florence was going to sit on top of Raleigh, Crawford recalls. When the storm bypassed his city, he says, I was celebrating that. And then I started hearing from my friends who got hit by the storm. I felt like I needed to do something. Crawford reached out to a handful of chefs who he thought might consider cooking for a fundraiser. He also contacted developer John Kane, who owns the Dillon, an 18-story office tower downtown. Crawford hoped to use the building's rooftop restaurant space for the event. Kane was willing, but had one request. Can I put you in touch with Willa? He asked. She wants to do something. Willa is Kane's wife and a community volunteer who says her greatest skill is connecting people. Before Crawford talked to her, his ambitions were modest relative to what the group eventually cooked up. I thought we'd do a little dinner and raise $50,000, he says with a chuckle. But when Willa Kane brought the Sunday supper team to Crawford's restaurant a few days later to discuss what they envisioned, that little dinner ballooned into two suppers for the ages. 3 weeks, that's how long Crawford and the Sunday supper crew had to whip up their plan. White tablecloths fluttered up and down Fayetteville Street, and a cross-section of the city gathered for a meal cooked by top chefs. Crawford was aware that the team had pulled off a similar event 2 years earlier, but he wasn't familiar with the fine-tuned process that they had developed to launch those big dinners. They had the infrastructure to pull it off, Crawford says. As we were sitting in that meeting, I'm learning what they do. a national template for fundraising, and I was blown away. The first Sunday Supper was in 2016 after Hurricane Matthew dealt a devastating blow to the North Carolina coast and further inland, killing 28 people and causing $4.8 billion in damage. The group began with a phone call between two Raleigh fundraising and public relations professionals with roots in eastern North Carolina. Joyce Cohn, who grew up in Moorhead City, called Harris Vaughn, a native of Eatonton. "We were worried sick that eastern North Carolina was going to get left behind," Vaughn says. "I asked, what are we going to do?" Cohn's response, "I've got this crazy idea. I cannot do it by myself." Her idea? Stretch a long dinner table down Fayetteville Street for a 1,000-seat dinner that would help raise money to help others. The youngest of seven children, Cohn has strong memories of her family's Sunday suppers. There was no radio, no television. The phone was off the hook. There was so much nourishment beyond the food at the table, she says. "I didn't realize how important it was to me until that hurricane and that acrimonious presidential campaign which led to our workplaces, churches, and homes being fractured. But these are all our people. We needed to do something for our people." They chose the Sunday after the 2016 presidential election for the first event, but that meant that they had only 30 days to prepare. One of the first things Vaughn did was ask one of his employees, Grayson Kane Sidebotham, to call her mother, Willa Kane, shortly joined the team. On the morning of the first big supper, more volunteers than were needed started showing up at 5:15 a.m. to set up tables and chairs. Diners came to feast on chopped barbecue, coleslaw, hush puppies, and sweet tea. But in the process, the meal became more than a fundraiser for hurricane relief. It was proof that despite political disagreements, strangers can come together to share a meal for the common good. The Sunday supper sold out and raised $189,000 for communities hard hit by the hurricane. "We were tapping into something in people's hearts and souls," Vaughn says. "It was warmth and humanity on display. It wasn't red, it wasn't blue, it wasn't black, it wasn't white. It was people, and there was a need for it." Kane, Cohn, and Vaughn realized that the Sunday supper could be replicated by community leaders anywhere as a way to respond to those communities' needs. Their mission expanded from a one-time hurricane relief project to addressing incivility, too. Their bipartisan group formed a nonprofit and created a shareable digital toolkit to move the Sunday supper beyond Raleigh. Kane recruited Courtney Crowder, who served as a legislative director and senior advisor to former Governor Beverly Perdue, to join the board. The mission to find a common cause resonated with him. "It seems we have to remind ourselves that we don't have to agree on everything," Crowder says. "We need to create space in the community during a time when our national discussion is hardened and lacking a certain amount of empathy. I think Sunday supper goes wherever a community needs it to go. It could be around a natural disaster. It could be around persistent poverty. It could be around a racial episode. That's when Sunday supper is at its best. People see themselves in it. It's an open source document that can address your community's needs." The idea has spread. In Charlottesville, Virginia, community members organized a Sunday supper after a white supremacist rally left 3 people dead and 34 injured in August 2017. In Durham, James Glenn, a business owner and former Duke University football player, helped organize an April 2018 supper for 500 people at the American Tobacco Amphitheater, which raised more than $100,000 to address food insecurity. Then came Hurricane Florence, which dropped as much as 30 inches of rain in some areas of eastern North Carolina, resulting in catastrophic flooding. The storm caused the deaths of 40 people and resulted in $17 billion worth of damage. That's when Chef Crawford connected with the Canes. The little dinner that he thought might raise $50,000 turned into an event at the Dillon that raised 8 times that much, $400,000. And the Sunday feast for 1,000 along Fayetteville Street between Martin and Morgan Streets raised another $50,000. Crawford has also joined the Sunday Supper Board, which is focused on awarding grants to restaurant owners, farmers, and fisheries in eastern North Carolina, spreading the word about this fundraising tool and bringing people together. If this is how we can model being unified again, Vaughn says, let's set some tables. You are listening to Our State Magazine on the North Carolina Reading Service. If you have any comments on our program, please call the studios 919-832-5138. There's an ad here that says the private university of choice in North Carolina. It's for Campbell University, leading with purpose. www.campbell.edu. Ladies who lunch. When the furniture designers, buyers, and browsers who swarm the annual High Point Market want to escape the crowds, they head to the basement of First United Methodist Church, where the best lunch in town comes with a heaping helping of charm. Written by Jennifer Brookland. Hundreds of people are coming for lunch today. But Gloria Halstead isn't ruffled. She gives the vegetable beef soup another stir and eyes the neat stacks of styrofoam cups. She follows the same routine that her mother Jane did 40 years ago when the ladies of First United Methodist Church first set up Parsons' Table to provide lunch for High Point Market visitors, hoping to raise extra cash for good works. That was 1978, the same year HGTV stars The Property Brothers were born. And long before showrooms at the International Furniture Market began hiring their own chefs to lure patrons to stay a little longer and spend a little more. That was back when people would come from around the country to buy furniture, but leave when their stomachs started rumbling for lunch. A lot has changed in four decades. Today, High Point outdoes itself by hosting the largest international home furnishings trade show in the world. Online planning tools, an app, and travel concierge services assist the 75,000 attendees who pour into the small city for the semi-annual occasion. Shuttles crisscross 8 neighborhoods, ferrying buyers and designers among 180 buildings with 12 million square feet of exhibit space. There are pop-up events, celebrity sightings, and seminars. There's a furniture fellowship prayer breakfast, canapes, and cocktails. There's a hashtag. But in the unassuming basement of First United Methodist, where the buffet ladies wait to serve chicken salad sandwiches on Ann Harris's homemade sourdough bread, things remain simple and familiar. Halstead ladles out cups of Uncle Ben's Polish chili. Susan Tuttle scoops tuna and egg salads. Volunteers lay out baggies of tomato slices and pickles, while just a block away, showrooms display tempered glass tables and boucle-swathed sectionals with walnut-finished feet. With some 400 meals served on the busiest market days, the pace is always hectic. But it's a special time for these women, too. Some of them have worked together since the inaugural Parsons Table, when the owners of Council Craft Furniture guaranteed the First United Methodist Women's Group that if they could make 50 lunches, 50 folks would show up to buy them. For the volunteers, it's a time not just for food, but also for fellowship. This is a kind of uniting thing within our church, says Harris, the former chair of Parsons Table. We have 3 worship services, and if you go to one, you don't see the people who go to the other 2. The lunch shift gives everyone a chance to catch up, she adds. There's a lot of camaraderie, a lot of laughter. A group that's been cooking together this long is bound to have inside jokes and stories that cycle through the kitchen chatter year after year. Betty Caddick's mother-in-law, for instance, was famous for an outrageous set of false teeth she carried around in a pouch. They were ugly, weren't they, Caddick says. She still has them in the drawer at home, even puts them on sometimes for a laugh. I wore them to church one time, she says. The ladies throw their heads back and cackle. Caddick was a Parsons Table co-chair for 9 or 10 years. She can't remember exactly. The time blurs. There was the year all of the salad ladies wore visors bedecked with ladybugs. There was the year the old church ceiling fell down and volunteers had to scramble to set up tables where people could eat without a chunk of plaster landing on their plates. There was the time Caddick's Sunday school class used the broken sink to rinse out the salad dressing, and, well, the maintenance director had to remop the floors after that one. With so many women, and some men too, volunteering over the decades, Parsons Table has become a well-oiled machine, comforting in its predictability, even as it continues to grow and everything around it changes. The group now offers delivery service and a pop-up tent right in the heart of the market. And its members are not above tweaking their offerings to meet a need. Once, when a British gentleman requested hot tea, they brought in a kettle, even though he was the only customer to ask for it. "We try to please," Harris says. When someone complained that the chicken salad was bland, Tuttle made a batch after batch until she came up with a boost. "We used the same recipe for 20 years. It was probably time," she admits. Halstead stopped adding extra salt to the vegetable beef soup, but she does add a full stick of butter to the white chicken chili. Julia Child says, "Fat tastes good, and I agree," she says, her blue eyes smiling. Those are the only changes she's made, though. She still lines up the pots exactly as her mom once did, back when Halstead worked as an attorney in Washington, D.C., but drove down to help her mother pull off Parsons Table. "She taught me everything I know," Halstead says. Her mother, Jane, who died in 2014, would have been proud of the $20,000 that Parsons Table raised last year for causes including a woman's shelter, an addiction recovery village, child development programs, and a community health clinic. "My mother had a real passion for this," says Halstead, who moved to North Carolina to help care for her mom. "She's the reason I'm here." And so, even though Halstead herself is not a member of the church, she takes her mother's place in the soup section twice a year, serving up steaming bowls of old favorites next to the women who sang hymns and swapped recipes with her mom. The lunch crowd has reached its peak, and the din is rising from the basement. A line forms in front of the dessert table, laden with home-baked cakes, pistachio, banana, red velvet, coconut, strawberry, carrot, chocolate, as diners make their way to pay. Indecision slows their pace. At a nearby table, Shelba Cornelissen takes dainty spoonfuls of vegetable beef soup, showing remarkable restraint around her slice of pig pickin' cake, plump with mandarin oranges and pineapple pieces. The U.S. advertising manager for Bridge for Design, an international resource for interior designers, Cornelissen has covered every market since she graduated from high school. "It's fabulous. I wouldn't miss it for anything," she says. Ann Smith works at the police department and doubles as a registrar at the market. Like many locals, she heard about Parsons Table through word of mouth and keeps coming back. "It's a great hideaway," she says over a bowl of chili. "It's the best-kept secret." Carolyn and Charles Riddle come by for sandwiches after finishing their morning shifts driving the shuttle bus around the market. Both are members of the First United Methodist, and Carolyn used to volunteer with Parsons Table. She knows all the ladies and how much work it will take to keep this tradition going, and she feels right at home sipping sweet tea at the simple folding tables. Halstead pops over to say hello and to thank the Riddles for supporting Parsons Table. They chat about this year's market and markets past. Halstead heads back to her soups. Riddle smiles as she watches her walk away and says, "She looks just like her mother." And now our mother's house for a small gathering of parishioners with no immediate ties to the Charlotte area. An after-church breaking of bread reveals the richness of a new extended family and the gifts that grow out of it. Written by M.E.N. Wright. A pair of rocking chairs and a petite glass tables sit on the low front porch of Adele McLean and Julia Harper's house in Steel Creek, a suburb at the far southwestern corner of Charlotte, near the Southern Carolina border. It's the perfect spot for relaxing with a pitcher of cold lemonade on a hot afternoon, a springtime wreath of lavender blush and pale green flowers hangs above the door, an inviting welcome to the best meal that some members of the Rock Worship Center will have all week. McLean, 71, and Harper, her 82-year-old aunt, are anchors of the church's Mother's Board, a committee of older women that acts as an auxiliary support network for the congregation, lending the wisdom and experience of their years in both practical and faith matters. Each board member is given the respectful title of Mother, together with her first name, to demonstrate her standing in the community. At their semi-regular Sunday dinners, McLean and Harper offer more than just a meal. The two matriarchs provide a warm space for transplants among their flock, some of them up from north, some of them from other parts of the south, to sit down and fellowship and feel, at least for a couple of hours, at home, no matter how far from home they may be. On this Sunday, McLean, in a sassy T-shirt with her vibrant red hair and a sporty natural cut, stands in a more contemporary contrast to Harper, who greets guests in the same elegant black dress and jewelry she wore to worship. One by one, their church family arrives with cups, paper plates, and side dishes to go along with the house favorites. Harper's sweet and sour ribs, deliciously sticky and tender, and McLean's collard greens and cabbage, a recipe she learned from a church friend back in her hometown of Clareton, Pennsylvania. I like mine hot and a little tangy, so I add hot pepper flakes and vinegar, McLean says. She prepared the greens in a pressure cooker that her daughter recently gave to her. First time I tried it, I was blown away. I put smoked turkey wings in it for 15 minutes, added the collards and cabbage, and when I opened the lid, the meat was literally falling off the bone. Within an hour, the house is at capacity. On every surface in the kitchen are pans of main dishes and sides, salmon, ribs, smothered turkey wings, fried chicken, baked mac and cheese, greens, sweet potato pie, peach cobbler, and banana pudding. It's a tantalizing spread, but before digging in, the group joins hands in prayer. After dinner, the guests clean up, and what's left goes home with someone who needs it, like the young women, or rather woman, who came one Sunday after a recent move to the area. She was so appreciative, McLean says, because she hadn't unpacked yet, and her kitchen wasn't set up to cook yet. But already, she felt at home. Growing up in Clareton, a mill town of 6,700, McLean took her family's Sunday dinners for granted. Often, company would come over. My dad and mom were natural hosts, she says. Years later, McLean got a message from Harper. A family friend from Clareton, Pastor Frank Jacobs, was establishing a church in Charlotte. His parents were members of the church I attended, McLean says, so we'd known him when he was a baby. Harper wanted to lend a hand with a new venture. I prayed about it, Harper says. The two decided to make a move to Charlotte in 2015. After joining the Mother's Board, Harper noticed a trend in the church. A number of members had no family in the Charlotte area. One Sunday, as she and McLean began cooking before the worship service, they decided to have a few people over afterward. And then we did it again, and again, and again, McLean says. The gatherings expanded as new people came into the fold, like Ladell Josie, a social worker who spends a lot of time on the road. Mother Adele makes everyone feel like they're at home, no matter what, Josie says. She's bringing back the whole family Sunday dinner, and it's a reminder of home. About a year into hosting the dinners, McLean and Harper's independence took a blow. The women, who were on fixed incomes, couldn't afford to renew the lease on McLean's Chevy Cruze. She had to let it go. It had been a key part of their fellowship. They drove it to the church to shop for their Sunday meals, to visit patients in the hospitals and nursing homes. When they were left without transportation, church members helped out. People would call and see if we needed to go anywhere, McLean says. Still, it was a struggle to keep up their usual schedule of helping the community and friends. But then, on the Thursday before Easter of this year, Stacy and Michelle Ford, Sunday dinner regulars, dropped by for a visit. They sat for a bit, and Stacy said, "Walk me to the door and see what I have out here." Harper recalls, sitting in front of the house was a Chevy Cruze, just like the one McLean and Harper had to give up. I looked outside and said, oh, you got a car. Well, that much was true. But this car didn't belong to the Fords. It was from McLean and Harper. After more than a year of relying on others to get around, the two had their own car again, courtesy of their regular dinner guests. We were absolutely stunned, Harper says. The Fords had decided to give them the car because of the gifts they'd received at McLean and Harper's Sunday dinners. I lost my mom 4 years ago, and Mother Adele's been someone I can talk to for advice or go to be lifted up in prayer, Michelle says. Our church family is our family in this area. God put us in a position to be able to be a blessing. Well, we have about two or three minutes left. Let's go back to the beginning of the magazine and find out what we're going to see here on page 22. Well, it's part of the We Live Here Farm Tour section. The town of Marshall, a berry on top. In Madison County, Fingers and Faces is the perfect canvas for smears of red and purple. The finishing touch, a scoop of sweet ice cream with a taste of tart. I've killed more berries than anyone in the state, Pam Clark says with a laugh. For the last 20 years, she's cultivated her berry-growing skills through trial and error at the berry farm in Marshall, tending to blueberries, blackberries, black raspberries, and occasionally red raspberries. I grow what I like, and I probably eat more than anyone else, she says. From mid-June through August, eager visitors arrive at this high mountain valley farm with level fields and gorgeous views. They head to the berry house for picking baskets and tips on selecting the ripest fruits. The best way to choose a ripe berry is to sample one, Clark says, and visitors dutifully follow this advice as evidenced by grinning faces and stained fingers. Sweeter than a raspberry and richer than a blackberry, black raspberries with their deep purple color do a fine job of dressing up the vanilla ice cream sold in the berry house. The berry's tartness complements the sweet flavor of the ice cream, which is served with wooden spoons, a memorable throwback to late summer school lunches. After black raspberries kick off the picking season, jumbo thornless Chester blackberries arrive. Thrilling young berry fans who can easily select and savor them without getting pricked. I love to see those little kids come out with the berry juice all over them because they've been sampling, Clark says. That's what makes it all worth it. If you wish to go, they are at 2260 Revere Road in Marshall. They have a website. It is The Berry Family LLC. An ad before we go here. Inspiring adventure, invest in the future. The North Carolina Outdoor Heritage Advisory Council is working to enable the next generation of passionate participants of North Carolina's outdoor heritage activities. And they are they do have a website, ncoutdoorheritage.org. And that's about all the time we have for today's episode of Our State Magazine. Hope you enjoyed it and that you'll listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Radio Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available to the podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Or comments, questions, call the studios, 919-832-5138. So long until next time.